Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast.
Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. I took off last week for the Memorial Day holiday, and I'm grateful I did because honestly, I was so excited to get back and record another episode. I feel like staying away for a week always makes me like so re-energized to come back stronger. Holidays are good like that, or just like taking some time off is good for the creative soul. So if you are a creative out there, I highly recommend just taking a little sliver of a break and coming back, and you'll feel so re-energized. So I'm feeling great and ready to tell you guys quite the story. I feel like this is one of those tales that not many people, I feel like I say this all the time, but not many people know about this specific component, this specific feud that I'm going to discuss today. It relates to cereal. It relates to an empire and a very famous, very known household name, but you might not know the secret feud that lies in the name. Like, what is in a name, you know? But like, there is a feud, a family feud between brothers that people don't really know about. And it's with the Kellogg family. The Kellogg family, yes, the cereal family, you know, and not to be confused with the Posts. There's a whole separate feud between the Post cereal empire and the Kellogg cereal empire, which is depicted in a lot of shows and movies. But, you know, aside from that, which I feel like a lot of people know about that specific feud, if you don't, I'll do an episode on it. But what people don't really know about is there's an underlying feud between the brothers, the Kellogg brothers. And I'm not going to spoil how it all ends. We're going to get into that in today's episode, but it is really interesting. And it kind of like, honestly, being an older sister with a younger sister, like it really did kind of give me a mirror to look at my own relationship with my sister and rethink some things. So anyway, buckle up. I'm not going to get into too much more because I don't want to spoil it for you guys. So I think we just get on into it. What do you think? Okay, let's go. Let's talk about breakfast, because honestly, I've had such a complicated relationship with breakfast throughout my life. I feel like when I was younger, it was an essential thing because, you know, I was going to school super early. My mom would make me, you know, a bowl of cereal or a slice of toast or something before school. It became just part of my daily routine. Nowadays, I've discovered coffee and I exercise first thing in the morning. So I'm still trying to strike a balance with my breakfast routine, like making sure I actually eat breakfast because sometimes I just prefer a large lunch. But if you're a breakfast person and you've ever had cereal, this episode will resonate. So for the cereal lovers out there, what made you hop on the cereal train? Like I said, you know, I grew up with it. My mom would make me a bowl of cereal in the morning. So it just became this ritualistic thing. But nowadays, you know, we eat cereal. Is it more of like a nostalgia thing or a convenience thing? Either way, in my research for this episode, I found that people's cereal preferences really run the gamut. I 100% thought initially when I asked my friends, my family, you know, they'd all be gung-ho for like Cinnamon Toast Crunch or Honey Nut Cheerios, like the classic sugary options in the cereal aisle. But instead, I've not talked to a single person so far that had the same favorite. Like everyone really ride or dies for different types of cereal. And there's so many out there now. You know, I've heard Honey Bunches of Oats, Smart Start, you know, Special K, Grape Nuts, like, you know, all of these things just as much as the child-focused alternatives like Fruit Loops, Cookie Crisp. I really loved, what were those, Fruity Pebbles? Like that was one of my favorites growing up. I loved when it like made the milk all flavorful. And that was like the finishing touch. The cherry on top was just like slurping the milk at the end. So, cereal preferences aside, let's travel back in time to explore the breakfast habits of Americans over time and how cereal ultimately came to be. Like, where did cereal come from? It's actually a really interesting story, and just overall how breakfast has evolved for Americans. And, you know, of course, there's many other cultures to consider, but today we're going to talk about it here in America. So, back in the colonial era, breakfast was simple, especially for working class people. They would eat leftovers from dinner the night before because it wouldn't keep long due to the lack of proper refrigeration and food storage practices at the time, which I never considered this. Like, you know, if you had meatloaf for dinner the night before, you'd be eating that for breakfast, which, you know, I've done that with like pizza before, but it's interesting to think that like there really wasn't a difference between like breakfast food and dinner food, you know, or they would eat porridge. This is sometimes referred to as cereal, but it was eaten hot rather than cold like the cereal we know today. So more similar to a, oatmeal, right? You can eat oatmeal hot or cold. I'm not an oatmeal girly, but I know that people do that. So culinary historian Sarah Johnson claims that as the nation grew and pockets of wealth began to develop, the breakfast preferences started to change. It actually reflected the traditional breakfasts of European aristocracy. There we go. We're bringing Europe into this, which included breakfast buffets with ham, sausage, eggs, pastries, and the works. So it always kind of starts, I mean, this makes sense. It always starts like over there in Europe and then comes over here, especially in the colonial era, like people are traveling and bringing their habits over. But again, this is really only amongst the uber wealthy people sipping their coffee, eating the spreads, you know, and reading their newspaper over a stunning white tablecloth. You know, oftentimes doted on by waitstaff, the whole nine yards. So it wasn't hitting everyone yet, really just the rich people. Then, as the 19th century came with the advent of industrialization, large breakfasts started to become more common. In cities like Chicago and Cincinnati, beef and pork production and distribution became common, so meats were more accessible to everyone. The large portions at breakfast became particularly popular in rural areas where the heavy morning meals fueled farmers and laborers for their day of work. Like they needed like a hearty breakfast to keep them going with their, you know, their manual labor. Once the Industrial Revolution truly hit, the nature of work in the United States changed completely. We know this, you know, factories were king. And this meant that lifestyles changed as well, from sleeping habits to eating habits. And breakfast was no exception. People went from farms primarily to factories and then offices with standardized schedules. So there was less time for food prep. Plus, it became increasingly clear that the diet of most Americans, which consisted of high levels of refined carbs, sugar, and meat, was not doing anyone any favors as far as health and longevity of life were concerned. So that was perfect timing for something new to enter the market for breakfast. Like something new that was quick, that wasn't super unhealthy and heavy. You know, people wanted that fast, healthy alternative to, you know, eating dinner from the night before, eating this super hearty spread that just like made them feel sluggish before their workday. And that's when the Kellogg brothers entered the scene. John Harvey Kellogg and Will Keith Kellogg had a very peculiar upbringing in Michigan. John and Will were born in 1852 and 1860, respectively, but more importantly, they were raised as Seventh-day Adventists, which, as you can imagine, that highly influenced their lives as children and then transferred into adulthood. And if you're unaware, to kind of break down what Seventh-day Adventism is, it's really worth the rabbit hole on the internet, honestly, like if you want to go down and just, you know, do the research into it, but they essentially believed in the imminent end of the world and the second coming of Christ. So Adventists, they were also strict believers in the dietary restrictions of the Old Testament, which included vegetarianism, so no alcohol, no tobacco, no tea, coffee, condiments, so like no fun, pretty much, because I love condiments. I don't know about you. I know there's some people out there that are like vehemently against condiments. Like my friend Colby hates ketchup. I just don't know how she lives. She doesn't like garlic aioli. Like how? So they're against all of that and minimal quantities of eggs and dairy products. So that is kind of, they had a, you know, more deep beliefs in other things, but as far as food, like that is how the foods impacted, or like how they had to be picky with their foods. Due to their religious beliefs, the Kellogg brothers did not have a typical education because their parents didn't think it would matter with the end of the world coming and all. Like, they're like, oh, the end of the world's coming, so like, why do we need to be educated? Let's not do that. So John especially was groomed to be a leader in the church, but instead he defied expectations and went on to earn his medical degree. So exactly what his parents didn't feel was necessary, because like the world was ending, he was like, let me just become a doctor. Or like, he got his medical degree. And not only that, he became a leader in the medical field, a celebrity doctor even. His patients included several U.S. presidents, Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, Amelia Earhart, and Sojourner Truth, to name a few. He published in respected medical journals and lectured at universities. However, his treatments and focus remained largely grounded in his religion's tenets of dietary abstinence. So even though he went on to become this doctor and, you know, go to medical school, even though his parents didn't really believe in that component of things, he still adhered to the Seventh-day Adventist dietary situation that I was talking about earlier. And his philosophy was coined biologic living. And in addition to all the dietary restrictions, it emphasized exercise, massage therapy, and drinking absurd amounts of water. Today, we would likely refer to it as wellness. Like, this is honestly what I aspire to do. You know, move my body, drink a lot of water, get massages. I mean, I don't really get a ton of massages, but just treating your body with care. That is what he believed in. I mean, of course, the condiments thing could never do that, but that was kind of what he believed in. But we'll see, things get extreme. So it was a natural next step for John to take over the Adventist Church Health Institute in Battle Creek, Michigan in 1876. Here, he was able to practice and preach the advantages of biologic living. And a little excerpt of one of my sources says that he focused primarily on patients' digestive health, you know, discussing and kind of debunking the evils of the fatty, greasy, salty, or spicy foods, and endorsing regular, powerful enemas. Yes, if you don't know what an enema is, Google it, to clear out one's digestive tract. Having studied gorillas in zoos and seeing that they had 4 to 5 bowel movements a day, he prescribed his patients to do the same and tried to serve foods that would help that process along. So like natural laxatives. Yeah, he took things extremely. Like that's what I was just trying to get across earlier. Like he believes in wellness, but to an extreme extent. So the Health Institute that John created, pretty much, eventually turned into a world-renowned medical center, spa, and resort called the Battle Creek Sanitarium. It was even dubbed a national holistic wellness destination, and thousands of people flocked there every year. There, John preached his biologic living philosophy, and people listened. He was one of the nation's first proponents of integral medicine, where he believed that you could improve mind, body, and soul all at once. All right, enter the invention of cornflakes, of cereal. We're going to talk about that now and how it was actually an accident. Like, it was invented by mistake. And I've talked about this before on my last podcast. You guys might remember I did a whole episode on, like, unconventional wellness and whatnot, like, from history. But I'm going to go a bit more in depth on how this happened. And little side note, if you ever have time just to like mindlessly scroll the internet, definitely Google, look up some articles on things that were created by mistake, like just other inventions out there that were created because of an accident, like something went wrong, or, you know, someone didn't do their job, or they were trying to make one thing and they ended up with something else. Like, this is honestly, it's the most fascinating things to read about, in my opinion. I want to do a whole episode on that, like just like things that were created by mistake. I actually need to write that down because that would be a good just like compilation episode, but I digress. Okay, so cereal, cornflakes specifically, was made by accident by the Kellogg brothers based on what I've read. So John's wife Ella and his brother Will, the Kellogg family, worked together in the kitchen and both John's wife Ella and his brother Will were likely involved in the invention of the famous Corn Flakes cereal. According to company history, it was one night in 1894 when a batch of wheat-based cereal dough was accidentally left out for an extended period of time, causing it to ferment. When rolled out into thin sheets, the slightly moldy dough produced perfect, large, thin flakes that became crispy and tasty in the oven. Over the next several years, Will Kellogg kept experimenting with the recipe and figured out that corn, rather than wheat, produced even crunchier, crispier flakes. Hence, the corn flakes, which put Kellogg, like the name Kellogg and this family, on the map, were born, kind of out of an accident. So I love little stories like that. Rather than be immediately sent out for mass distribution like you might think, though, the corn flakes that John called granose, legend has it, he was trying to make granola, and that is why, like, that's why the dough was even, like, out, and or he was making something similar to granola, and then, you know, the cereal was born. So he called it granose, which I think is, like, a way to combine grain, maybe, like, grain, granola, and the scientific suffix O-S-E for metabolism. Whatever it was, you know, this name obviously didn't stick. Granose, can you imagine if we were calling, like, cereal or like cornflakes granose? Like, it just doesn't really, like, satisfy, you know, tickle that part of the brain like it should. But they were a huge hit in general. So let's talk a bit more about Will Keith Kellogg. So this is not John Kellogg, it's his brother that I mentioned at the very top of the story and just now when I was talking about the happy accident of cornflakes. Let's talk a bit more about him, because I feel like I focused so much on John. I'm not forgetting about him. He is a character that should not be overlooked, you know, as he often was in his lifetime, actually. He kind of lived in the shadow of John. He was 8 years younger than him. You know how that goes, like the younger brother, kind of, you know, especially when the older brother is so bright and so loud, it can kind of overshadow the younger sibling. So let's pull him out of the shadows and talk about him a bit. So Will, often nicknamed WK, was the stealthy and strong businessman. Like, John was the doctor, Will was the business, you know, and the sanitarium, which the brothers ran together, would have crashed and burned without Will's guidance. He was essentially the chief of staff with no title and low compensation for 25 years. Remember that I said, you know, Will played a significant role in perfecting the cornflakes known as granose. Well, he also saw granose as a fantastic business opportunity. And while John was focused on using it for his patients in the sanitarium, Will saw the potential of it becoming like an American household name. You know, he saw this untapped market. Like I said earlier, like, people were desperately looking for a breakfast alternative that was easy, quick, and healthy, you know? So he saw a world in which, like, he could bring this invention to every kitchen in America. The market for light, healthy breakfast was wide open for the taking. So the brothers came together with each of their areas of expertise and formed the Sanitas Nut Food Company. And they even experimented with other products as well. So they had the cornflakes, or rather granose at this point in time, but the cornflakes, they had that. And then they also introduced slow-baked cereal, granola biscuits, wheat flakes, peanut butter, and a cereal-based coffee substitute. But of course, you know, cornflakes were the OG, and they were still the crowd favorite at this time. The Kelloggs at first sold their products mainly by mail order to their ex-patients, like people that had been discharged from the sanitarium and, you know, still wanted to buy the foods that they were being served that helped them in their process or whatever. But then they began advertising in newspapers and on billboards. And so naturally, that's when the competition started to roll in. And among the most successful was a man named C.W. Post, a one-time patient at the Battle Creek Sanitarium. So the Battle Creek Sanitarium, if you recall, that was where the Kellogg brothers, you know, had their patients come in, and they gave them diet plans and all these plans, exercise plans, etc. And then, you know, helped them as much as they could at the time with their limited knowledge, I guess, like, they and their kind of unconventional practices to get over, like, either their chronic illnesses, their depression, their, you know, obesity, whatever, like, a variety of things that they tried to treat at the sanitarium. But C.W. Post was actually a resident, or a patient at the Battle Creek Sanitarium. And I'm actually in the process of reading kind of a slightly fictionalized version of events between the Posts and the Kelloggs, which I'm going to get into in a minute, like the actual story. But if you guys are interested in reading more, it's called The Magnificent Lives of Marjorie Post. And I actually don't remember who wrote the book, but if you Google it, it'll come right up. And it's very good. And then also, separately, if you want like more of a funny parody version of like the whole ordeal, the cereal wars of it all, check out Unfrosted on Netflix. It's a movie with a star-studded cast. It's, you know, kind of like a certain kind of humor, but like Amy Schumer's in it, a bunch of like big names are in it. But Marjorie Post is played by Amy Schumer, which is why she's top of mind. Anyway, so just an aside, if you guys want more on the cereal wars, check that out. But we're going to dive into the competitors, the competition that really put the war in cereal wars. So in fact, at the time of C.W. Post's stay at the sanitarium, he was too poor to afford the stay at the facility, so he offered to work in the kitchen to help offset the cost. Lo and behold, this gave C.W. Post a front row seat to the cereal and granola cooking methods used by the Kellogg brothers. So he was there to get the help from the sanitarium, but he was also, you know, involved in the process to the point where he was very close to the cereal. From there, he adapted Kellogg's cereal recipe into his own mass-produced version, Grape Nuts, to tremendous success. So he essentially kind of ripped off the way that the Kelloggs were doing things, but made it better, in his opinion, and it became a cutthroat competition. I'm not sure, you know, why he or how he got around like the trademarking of it all and like the patenting. I don't know if maybe there wasn't that sort of thing at the time. I don't know how they got away with it. The Posts got away with this, but they somehow did. And so they became a cutthroat competitor to the Kellogg brothers. And Post even bought exclusive rights to manufacture the cereal rolling machine needed in the cereal production process, equipment that Will Kellogg originally helped design. So he like got the rights to manufacture this material, this equipment that was needed to make the stuff that was like made by the Kelloggs. Like, it's just so funny how he like literally did not give a crap about, you know, crossing over into completely infringing on, you know, like this just feels wrong, but he did it. I don't know. I guess it happens all the time, especially in history. And so of course this ignited quite a feud between the Posts and the Kelloggs. Post and Kellogg were the company names respectively. You might recall those from the cereal aisle, like seeing them on labels and whatnot. So let's take a moment to discuss Charles William, aka C.W. Post. Born in 1854, Post took a while to find his calling in the breakfast cereal industry because his journey started out with some health struggles. He suffered from a variety of different ailments, including dyspepsia, which is indigestion today, which led him to seek alternative diets and health regimens. Inspired by his stay at the Kellogg Sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan, Post became interested in dietary reform and the potential health benefits of cereal grains. In 1895, Post introduced his first cereal product called Grape Nuts, like I just talked about, which was made from wheat and barley, and the name was derived from its key ingredients, grape for grape sugar and nuts for the nutty flavor. Despite initial skepticism, Grape Nuts gained popularity largely due to Post's aggressive marketing tactics. So, of course, it was modeled off of the Kellogg recipe, but he kind of took their recipe and made it tastier, made it sweeter. That was from what I've gathered from reading about it in depth. That was kind of the difference. Anyway, Post was a pioneer in advertising, employing innovative strategies to promote his products. He distributed free samples, offered money-back guarantees, and utilized catchy slogans like "Eat grape nuts and you'll be on the right track." And this was kind of, he was kind of a trailblazer in this sense. Like, this really wasn't happening in the 1880s and 90s. Like, this was a long time ago, guys. Like, if you really think about it, like, people were in such a different place in life at this time. And his advertisements often touted the health benefits of his cereals, claiming they could cure a variety of ailments from indigestion to nervousness. So of course, you know, this would never fly today. Like the FDA would be all over this, shutting it down. But back again in the 1890s, you can get away with this stuff. In 1897, Post followed up the success of Grape Nuts with another breakthrough product called Post Toasties. This corn-based cereal became a household staple, further solidifying Post's position in the industry. So in a nutshell, Charles, C.W. Post, and the Post Company was crushing it. You know, they really like to make a splash in terms of like their marketing, their advertising, you know, their offerings to customers, you know, like satisfaction guarantees, all of that sort of thing. And like all of these, you know, bold claims like this will cure this, 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 like this will change your life. Like they were really good at that. But let's talk about John Kellogg. So John Kellogg, you know, in response to all of this, he honestly wasn't really fazed by the competition, because he was more concerned with reforming American eating habits. He was more focused on that than having like a punchy edge. But Will Kellogg, John's brother, was more focused on taking control of the market that they single-handedly trailblazed. So this kind of created a bit of a rift between the brothers, because like John was like, you know what, like whatever, we don't care about Post, we're going to continue, like we're really like invested in this healthy, they had the sanitarium and whatnot, like they want to continue on that road, but and like not change their ways, kind of like stick in the mud where they are. Whereas Will was very concerned with, you know, beating out the Posts, like he really wanted to come for them. So there's a bit of a like tension growing between the Kellogg brothers, and then like CW Post is just crushing it in all arenas, though he kind of stole his idea. So when you think about cereal wars and like what's going on here, you might assume that the real feud was between CW Post, who stole, quote, stole the idea for cereal from, or like his Grape Nuts, like he kind of took the Kellogg idea and made it better. You know, it should be, the feud should be between the Kellogg's and the Posts, right? But the real cereal feud kind of became this thing between John and Will, you know, not Kellogg and the other brands, because there's some tea here. So when Will realized that his brother John did not have the desire to grow the brand at all, Will took matters into his own hands and bought the rights to the flake cereal recipe that put them on the map. He then started his own company, the Battle Creek Toasted Cornflake Company, in 1906. So he said, he really said, let me go my own way. Like, I'm going to go my own way. And his version of the cornflakes had malt, sugar, and salt in the dough. So unhealthy ingredients, according to, you know, what John would think. And he invested a lot of his profits into advertising, just like CW Post had. One campaign told the reader to, quote, wink at your grocer and see what you get. Can you imagine today? That just like simply wouldn't fly. Like, wink at your grocer and see what you get. What you got was a free sample of cornflakes. That's like what it continued to say. So this campaign like essentially meant that if you wink at your grocer, they will give you a free sample of cornflakes. Very sexually charged, in my opinion, for this time period. Like, it was like the, you know, 1906. And the campaign increased sales by a factor of 15 in New York City, and the company was rapidly profitable. So it actually did result in a spike in sales. By 1909, Will's company was churning out 120,000 cases of cornflakes a day. John, who eventually resented his brother's success, later fought him for the rights to use the family name. So, you know, the feud thickens, even though Will is like crushing it with, you know, CW Post, like who, you know, at this point, like he's crushing it. He doesn't really like seem to care about the competition. Like he still cares about one competition or one competitive aspect, which is his brother, John. So John, let's talk about him. Will is just, you know, crushing it over here with his company. John, his Sanitas Nut Food Company, was still in business. So both companies were simultaneously using the Kellogg name in some way, shape, or form. In 1911, Will won the lawsuit for exclusivity of the family name. But the legal battle didn't end there. It turned into a year-long ordeal that ended in 1920 when the Michigan State Supreme Court ruled in Will's favor due to his success at popularizing his now ubiquitous product. So they're kind of fighting over who can just call their company Kellogg, pretty much. Clearly, there's some drama here, and that's why it took so long for them to figure their shit out, for lack of a better way to put it. In the meantime, Will kept grinding. After the cornflakes' success, Will developed Rice Krispies and shredded wheat. He started selling bran flakes in 1915 and all bran in 1916. Once he won the Kellogg name legally, Will renamed his business to the Kellogg Cereal Company in 1922. Another fun fact, the rooster mascot on Kellogg's cereal boxes, which you might be able to envision in your head right now, like I can envision it very clearly what it looks like, is used because Will actually, he liked the Welsh word for rooster, which was Kellogg or Kellogg. It sounded like his last name, Kellogg. So that's why. I don't know how he like came up with that or how he landed on that, but that is interesting. Like I never knew why the logo was a rooster, but now I do. In the background, John Kellogg continued the operation of Sanitas, which was renamed to Battle Creek Food Company in 1921. And from there, the brothers went their separate ways. Like Kellogg Company went one way, Battle Creek Food Company went the other way. And you may think that the whole legal ordeal of like who can use the Kellogg name, Will or John, was the reason for this whole feud. And, you know, that in turn created this rift between them that would last until the day they died. But in fact, the relationship had been tumultuous throughout their entire life. Like, they didn't need this fight over a name to solidify that. As you recall, Will was overlooked for his contributions to the sanitarium as an adult, but apparently John, you know, even growing up, he always humiliated and browbeat his brother Will. When they were kids, if it was physical attacks as well as taunting and such, and then when they worked together, the doctor, John, treated him like a lackey. This is a quote from a source close to them. He paid him very poorly. He humiliated him in front of the guests. The doctor was so busy that he would ride his bike across the campus. Will would run and huff and puff alongside him, taking notes, so the doctor wouldn't miss a stitch on his great ideas. They didn't have a great relationship. So it kind of feels like, you know, John treated his younger brother Will as this sidekick when, you know, Will eventually just got sick of being treated like this. But John was definitely made aware of all the work that Will put into the sanitarium upon his departure in 1906. Because once Will was no longer there running the place, it fell apart almost immediately. It struggled to find its footing, but made do until, you know, the Great Depression hit. By that time, Dr. Kellogg was near retirement, and those who took over overextended themselves by building a 15-story patient tower and added a lot of luxurious amenities. The Depression struck then, and then they couldn't pay their mortgage, and then the sanitarium went into receivership, and, you know, from there it kind of just unraveled. It was sold to the federal government in 1943. So if the sanitarium took a nosedive, what do you think happened to John's Battle Creek Food Company? Surprise, surprise, it did not fare as well as the Kellogg Cereal Company, that's for sure. Although, to John Kellogg's credit, the company, which had a 60-product line, which is actually a lot of products for this competitor, you know, not actually the Kellogg Company, it actually stayed operational until his death in 1943. Unfortunately, the whole estate was put into his foundation until the trustees misused and misappropriated the funds. Ultimately, all the money from the estate was squandered by the early 1960s, so they weren't able to keep it going after his death, even though he kind of wanted it to keep going. Like, they ran out of money from his estate. All right, so it's not looking too good for John Kellogg at this point in our story. I mean, he's died, his company has gone poof, and his sanitarium has gone poof, and, you know, he doesn't have really much of a legacy. Meanwhile, his, you know, his brother Will is crushing it over at the Kellogg Food Company. But what about, you know, John's legacy as a medical professional? You know, he was a doctor. He helped so many people. Surely, since he was this celebrity doctor and known around the world, he had that going for him in his legacy. Well, not exactly. While his ideas about preventative medicine through proper nutrition and exercise were groundbreaking for his time, you know, and they really were, like, people weren't really considering, you know, that eating habits and moving your body could contribute positively to, you know, physical ailments, mental ailments. Like, people didn't really make that connection, like the body-mind connection at that point, and like just, you know, thought about reframing habits. Like, they just really kind of lived in the same way that their ancestors had lived and whatnot. So he did really disrupt thinking at that time with his sanitarium, with all of that. But he was a very, very peculiar man and very peculiar doctor. Some might call him a quack. Like, he literally walked around in this like white lab coat with a cockatoo. Sorry, different bird. Cockatoo perched on his shoulder. So he really created this image for himself. And, you know, medically speaking, his treatments were largely grounded in his religious misconceptions. And some were outright ludicrous and weird. I touched on this earlier, like, his techniques were strange and very questionable. Like, you know, doctors would analyze the things that he prescribed today and say this was out of line. Like, he should be disbarred, you know, for the things he was doing. Like, he was prescribing those enemas that I talked about earlier, but it went beyond that. Like, you know, there were special machines that were administering these enemas, like sometimes with, you know, a pint or two of liquid. Like, it just kind of freaks me out even thinking about it, like pumping that into the patient's bowels, 15 quarts of water per minute. But he was also an advocate of yogurt enemas. Yes, yogurt enemas. He also advised that people chew each bite at least 40 times to aid digestion. So while they were eating something like that was prescribed by him, they would have to chew 40 times at least, like, before they could swallow. And he even invented a chewing song to go along with this idea of chewing 40 times before you swallow. The song went a little something like, chew, 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 that is the thing to do. And you would kind of just repeat that in your head until like a certain number of times, and then you could swallow your food. So very interesting tactics. You know, some treatments are more barbaric than, you know, than these, but I'm not going to discuss them on the podcast. You guys can look them up if you want. But he did some very weird, questionable things. Needless to say, we don't think back to Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and, you know, revere his medical practices. I don't think anyone is really still doing the things that he did, like yogurt enema. Are you kidding me? But we'll think of him as Will Keith's brother. That's what we'll think of him as, which is really funny how the tables have turned. Like, you think about, you know, the two brothers and how, you know, John always kind of let his brother Will sit in his shadow and, you know, run after his bike with a notepad. But now that's where the story shifts. Like, Will becomes the Kellogg brother. In contrast to John, Will is still known for being the world leader in the cereal market and truly spearheading the birth of a new industry. Following the turmoil with his brother, Will was joined by his son, John L. Kellogg, in the business, who streamlined the company's operations. But Will forced him out in 1925. Some say, so more drama follows the Kelloggs, some say that it was because he divorced his wife for a woman at the office. But others think that it's because John wanted to explore new ingredients for the cereals, like oats, and Will was not on board. It's actually really interesting that he named his son John. Like, isn't that kind of funny? Like, they had this feud, but he named his son John. Like, I'm curious about that. So there's two Johns in our story now. We have John Sr., John, like, the brother, and then John, the son of Will. Anyway, so John, Will's son, sorry, I'm like getting confused by myself. Will's son, John L. Kellogg, was forced out of the business because of, you know, we don't really know exactly why. Either an affair of sorts or because he was like just trying to be too out there with his ideas. And in fact, no one lasted long under Will's critical eye. In 1930, Will was now an older man, he gave a majority interest in the company to his charitable organization, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, instead of maybe, I don't know, any of his relatives. But he was highly successful in his philanthropy. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation is actually a $9 billion foundation and does really remarkable work to this day. Will Kellogg died in Battle Creek in 1951 at the age of 91. And rather than being admired for his accomplishments, he was more so remembered for his imposter syndrome. He never quite thought that what he did was good enough and therefore struggled to delegate or let anyone in to help him. When he died, his grandson wrote, quote, "Nobody really shed a tear. He never really enjoyed his life or the people in it, and it showed." Ugh, and you know what? This gives me shivers because I have some of these tendencies that I just listed. Like, I am the kind of person in my work where I have a very hard time delegating. Like, I am getting better. I'd say in my personal life, like, I'm good at letting people in, but I still have my boundaries and my walls, and, like, it's been a long road of getting here to the point where, like, I trust people. But it is one of those things where you're starting a company, like, it is your baby, and it is hard to let other people hold your baby, you know? But it's something you need to do to then have a legacy that's more than just imposter syndrome, you know? Like, but poor Will, like, he did such a great thing with this company and his philanthropy and getting out of his brother's shadow. Like, it is a shame that, you know, nobody shed a tear at his funeral. Like, I don't like to hear that, honestly. Justice for Will. Anyway, moral of the story here is that there's a night and day difference in the outcomes for the Kellogg brothers. Like, you might have thought this story was going to be about the Posts and the Kelloggs. You know, it really wasn't, because there's a deeper feud between John and Will. And imagine if they had just come together and worked together. You know, maybe Will would have had a more full life, you know, if they would have maybe overcome their differences, had a nice long chat about it and, like, got over it. And just weren't so stubborn, you know? Underneath it all, they both struggled with what truly mattered to them, you know, each other and their families. And after their legal battles, they rarely spoke to each other again. Their last face-to-face meeting was a terrible argument, and John died only a few months later. I wonder if they came to regret how, you know, acidic and bitter their relationship became. Despite all the success that came of the Kellogg name, they lost their way. So there you have it, the crazy tale of how cereal came to be and the feud between brothers that, you know, ultimately never really felt resolved. Like, it's just funny how they both, you know, they started the sanitarium. Of course, like, there's this underlying kind of resentment that is building in Will, you know, while his brother is making him run after his bike with a notepad to keep all of his cereal thoughts. Like, you know, it's just, I can't get that visual out of my head. Clearly, I've brought it up a few times now, but, you know, it went from that to them going their own way with each of their companies, Will, you know, wanting to stay with it and with the times and his competitors, CW Post, and, like, he wanted to continue to grow and evolve, whereas John, stick in the mud, just kind of wanted to keep things how they were and eventually went under because of that. Like, he didn't evolve, and so he was trampled, and, like, ultimately, you know, he believed in some really wacky things that probably affected a lot of people really negatively throughout his, but he was, you know, again, he was trying his best, I guess, for the time, but also, you know, it's just, yeah, there's a lot more to this story, the cereal wars of it all. Like, there's a lot more if you consider the Posts and the Kelloggs, and I can go into more detail maybe in another episode, but I don't really feel like most people know about the component of the Kellogg brothers feud. Like, I feel like no one really knows about that. So I thought I'd get into it in today's episode, and I have. So yeah, I hope you guys think about this the next time you walk down the cereal aisle and, you know, think about the Kellogg brothers and their crazy journey to cereal domination and the result of a terrible family feud. So thank you guys for listening to this episode of Found Objects Podcast. And remember, things aren't always as they appear. Goodbye. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.